Welcome to SCOTUSCast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and the decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to SCOTUSCast. I'm your host, Kyle Hammerness, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. We are here today to discuss Trump versus Anderson, in which the Supreme Court issued a 9-0 decision on March 4th, 2024. We are joined today by Professor Derek Muller. Derek is a professor of law at Notre Dame Law School, where he teaches election law, civil procedure, and evidence. His research focuses on the role of states in the administration of federal elections, the constitutional contours of voting rights and election administration, the limits of judicial power in the domain of elections, and the Electoral College. And with that, I'd like to turn things over to our guests to discuss the overview of the case and the court's decision.
Sure. So Trump v. Anderson, I've been on enough of these calls and related calls. I think you might be familiar with it, right? The state of Colorado, in a 4-3 decision by the Colorado Supreme Court, had held that Donald Trump had engaged insurrection for purposes of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. As a result, it concluded he could not appear on the Republican primary ballot in that state, kept him off it, but stayed the ruling as the decision was appealed to the United States Supreme Court, which had expedited review. It took a little over 3 weeks for it to issue the decision. And so now we have that long-awaited decision. Unsurprising to most, I think, is after oral argument, the sense was that at least 8 justices, if not all 9, were inclined to reverse the Colorado Supreme Court on some theory that the state of Colorado or a single state didn't have this power to exclude ineligible candidates from the ballot, didn't have the power to enforce this for varying structural or practical reasons. There's going to be a question from the court about how it got there. So the decision came out. It's a per curiam decision, although I shouldn't speculate, but it reads in some respects like the voice of Chief Justice Roberts. Per curiam, a unanimous result. That is 9-0, essentially saying that Colorado lacks this power, but some sharper elbows on the path there, the path not only to that one holding, but whether other holdings should be reached. So 6 justices, Chief Justice Roberts, Justices Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett, all agreed with sort of the reasoning in the per curiam opinion. And then there was a concurring opinion jointly authored by Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson, concurring in the judgment only, but agreeing with sort of the heart of that part of the decision. So I'm going to focus on that for a moment. It's part 2B of the per curiam decision. And that part of the decision really focuses on sort of this overall structural take of the Constitution, actually from the text, structure, context, and so on. And really, it begins with a quotation from Term Limits versus Thornton, a 1995 case, saying that states had no power to add term limits or additional qualifications for congressional candidates. And from there, it cites that case, which had in turn cited the great Justice Joseph Story in his commentaries on the Constitution, to say that if states are exercising power in federal elections, that power has to come from some source in the Constitution. So if you are looking at Section 3 of the 14th Amendment in the context of a presidential election, where is the state power? Well, it's certainly not going to be found in the 14th Amendment, which is a constraint on state power. Section 5 gives Congress the power to enforce it. It gives no power to the states. As you run through the rest of the Constitution, you can't find other provisions of the Constitution empowering states. Article 1 and Article 2 deal with congressional elections, but it's not clear that implicitly within them is the later power to come back and enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. By the sort of structural provisions of the Constitution, this is a provision that's designed for congressional enforcement, for congressional remedies and congressional mechanisms. as a practical matter, it makes very little sense for states to add these sorts of burdens on presidential candidates. If they want to do it for state candidates, it's their own thing, but to do so for presidential candidates makes very little sense. It makes very little sense given that Congress can lift the disability by a two-thirds vote. So for a state to step in and hold a candidate not qualified, for Congress to swoop in later and have to say, well, now we're going to lift the disability so this candidate is not disqualified, would seem to burden Congress. And then at the very end, sort of, there are a series of practical concerns that one state's evidentiary law or one state's procedural setup for how these challenges are filed could have a ripple effect throughout the United States, and we might reach inconsistent verdicts across the United States. And states in particular have less of an interest in presidential elections simply because they are national offices, the national office in nature. And the notion that states could adjudicate qualifications, make these determinations and contested factual claims and reach kind of a patchwork result across the United States, not something that makes a whole lot of sense structurally. So that was part 2B of the per curiam opinion, joined in full by Justice Barrett and joined again in logic, if not in full, by the concurring opinion by Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson. So that could have been it, right? That would have been a lot easier of a story to talk about. But instead, there got to be a lot of friction on the court in a different context. So part 2A of the opinion, and this is where Justice Barrett peels off, along with the other concurring justices, addresses sort of a separate question, which is not whether or not states have the power to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. It's more a question of who else and in what context has the power to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And for that, the court turns to sort of the way that Section 3 is set up. It speaks about how Congress has this role now to enforce the provisions of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Section 5 of the 14th Amendment provides for Congress to have the power to enforce this provision of the Constitution with appropriate legislation. That appropriate legislation must meet, in the words of other Supreme Court precedent, including City of Bernie versus Flores, must be congruent and proportional to remedy the concerns that are addressed by these provisions of the Constitution, that when Congress steps in and enforces, it provides this sort of holistic remedial scheme. And when we look at the fact that we're dealing with this question, insurrection, and Justice Kavanaugh at oral argument did say the word insurrection stands out to him, it requires an ascertainment or requires a determination. This is something the Colorado Supreme Court recognized was necessary in this case, the determination of whether someone engaged in insurrection, which required procedures and factual findings. And this is also what Justice Chase on the United States Supreme Court, then riding circuit as a circuit justice in 1869, said in a case called Griffin's case. And Griffin's case has a lot of attention in some of the scholarly discourse, where a federal judge was sitting in habeas 1 year after ratification of the 14th Amendment, which was ratified in 1868. So in 1869, he's sitting in habeas and he's hearing a habeas challenge from Griffin, who had been convicted in West Virginia state court. And he's challenging the conviction in federal court to say, well, my conviction is invalid because it was adjudicated or issued by a judge who was barred from holding office by Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And Chase, writing this opinion, says, look, I'm not in a position to be able to determine these things. In part, I have to make a determination, or to use some of the language that the court here quotes from, proceedings, evidence, decisions, and enforcements of decisions are indispensable. Saying unless he's given some guidance, especially from Congress, to figure out what to do here, the justice is not in a position to make this adjudication in court. So part 2A of the opinion really rides heavily on Congress's role here. Congress's role, the language says Congress, or the Constitution empowers Congress. It enables Congress, subject to judicial review, to pass appropriate legislation. And Congress's Section 5 power is critical when it comes to Section 3. So the court provides these sorts of statements as it then leads into the argument that the state lacks the power. At the very end of the opinion, the per curiam opinion says these two things kind of go hand in hand. All of these things are essential. It's that Congress is the one that does these things and that states lack the power to do so. Now, Justice Barrett writes separately to say, I agree on the states lack the power. We don't need to decide anything else today. I would not go in the path that the majority has done. And then you have the concurring opinion by Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson. Again, while they seem to agree with part two of the opinion, essentially agreeing that states don't have any such authority, they fracture very badly with the majority's approach, thinking about this congressional role. Some of the language the court that the concurring opinion uses, saying that these musings about Griffin's case and about congressional power are as inadequately supported as they are gratuitous. And they go on to suggest that Section 3's text doesn't say that this is congressional enforcement alone. They point out that other provisions of the Constitution, including the Reconstruction Amendments, including things like due process and equal protection and the abolition of slavery, don't require additional congressional implementing legislation. They worry about how this is going to be applied in the future and whether or not they're adding these constraints on how Congress goes about enforcing Section 3 and prohibiting other actors from enforcing Section 3. Sort of one concrete example they give is the concern that the it forecloses judicial enforcement of that provision, such as might occur when a party is prosecuted by an insurrectionist and raises a defense on that score. The notion being that without congressional implementing legislation, if you have someone who had taken an oath to support the Constitution, engaged in insurrection, and now is serving as a judge, it would be impossible for somebody to raise a defense to say this judge is not authorized to hold this office without some kind of implementing legislation. So there were some sharp elbows there on the court on this provision. Again, five justices. So there was a majority on the view that this is something that requires congressional legislation, at least to some degree, along with a series of a more general agreement that states lack this power. So a few things to talk about here. The first is the court doesn't touch really any factual issues. It doesn't touch questions about whether January 6th was an insurrection, whether Donald Trump engaged in an insurrection, whether or not his speech or his conduct was protected, was not protected, whatever it was. It doesn't really touch any of that at all. These are just pure legal questions that the court is focused on. Another is that this really closes the door and any of these ballot challenges going forward, whether it's the primary election or the general election, the court is quite clear that there's no role for the state in enforcing these provisions. Another is that the opinion is very centered on Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. So it doesn't seem to foreclose the possibility that states exercising their power under Article 2 of the Constitution to exclude, say, a 21-year-old from the ballot or a Nicaraguan national from the ballot might continue to be able to do so. Instead, the opinion looks much more at Section 3 and how the 14th Amendment shifts this balance of power among the federal government and the state governments to say that it's foreclosing some authority from the states and that there's not affirmative enforcement authority given to the states as a result of this opinion. So it seems very much cabined to what's happening with the 14th Amendment and doesn't really touch on other presidential qualifications disputes, election disputes, ballot access disputes, if we're just dealing with Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. It also seems that it would appear to foreclose challenges that even might arise after the election. This is some of the opinion that I'm still wrapping my mind around and trying to understand how different parts of the opinion interact with one another. But the court's emphasis on speaking about Congress and legislation and how that remedy needs to be tailored adequately to the remedy that or to the harm that you've identified really does seem to say that challenges under, say, the Electoral Count Reform Act on January 6th, 2025 by members of Congress would be inappropriate, or that challenges to agency activity under Section 706 of the Administrative Procedures Act might be improper. That is to suggest that somebody lacks the authority because they were appointed by somebody ineligible or because they themselves are ineligible. And it's very hard to identify exactly what the court is doing when it is when it is suggesting that Congress has a role here with legislation. What are those things that Congress can do apart from legislation, such as seating its own members versus enacting legislation? What things by, as the concurring opinion points out, general federal statutes, you know, such as the Administrative Procedures Act or the Electoral Count Reform Act, what kinds of deference is going to be given to Congress when it is acting pursuant to those rules or when courts are acting pursuant to those rules, rather than things under its enforcement authority under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. So there are some myriad questions that are ahead. So it fails to provide some of the clarity, which I think was part of the goal of Part 2A of this opinion, that might close the door on some of these challenges going forward. But I think, and at least my sense is, that the intent of this provision is to foreclose those challenges. And while they might not formally be closed off, I think it's going to be much harder to bring any such challenges. And I've already seen a number of suggestions that there's cold water being thrown on these challenges. Some members of Congress are introducing legislation to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, again, getting the cue from the Supreme Court here that it has a role to play here. And, I think there's very little likelihood that we get through this Congress, but it is at least the understanding that this is a congressional responsibility in a case like this. And again, I think now it's just left to the political process. There'll be major questions about presidential immunity coming up in the weeks ahead as the Supreme Court hears that case, number of criminal challenges in the United States, the ordinary political process playing out where candidates are vying for the delegates and trying to get enough delegates to win the convention, onto the general election, and all the things that happen in that domain. So I think there's not going to be a closing off of the fact that the public will continue to intensely dispute what is an insurrection, whether or not Trump engaged in an insurrection, and so on going forward. But I think it has at least closed that door when it comes to states attempting to enforce it for their ballot access provisions.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is essential to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.